Hello, and welcome to the Comics Ate My Brain Weekly Roundup podcast. I'm Tom Bondurant, and this week we'll be talking about comics from August 19th, 2009, including Batman Streets of Gotham number 3, Blackest Night Superman number 1, Brave and the Bold number 26, Final Crisis Aftermath Dance number 4, Justice League of America number 36, Supergirl number 44, Superman Annual number 14, and Wednesday Comics number 7. And yes, I am feeling a little bit better, well, a lot better, but obviously my voice has not caught up with the rest of my body. But we carry on anyway. I have a tall glass of a favorite beverage here to soothe my sore throat, and I've got a small stack of comics to get through, and we're just gonna get through it. We begin this week with Final Crisis Aftermath Dance number 4, written by Joe Casey, penciled by Chris Cross and Eduardo Panseca, inked by Rob Stahl, Wayne Fosher, and Sandro Ribeiro. And I, once again, standard apologies for mispronunciation apply. This issue is probably the first issue of the miniseries, and I know that this issue marks the two-thirds point, where I really felt like I knew what was going on. And that's not to say that the issue, that the miniseries hasn't had its charms up till now, but this issue, I think, and I don't mean to sound like a smart aleck, but I think I finally started to detect a plot amongst all of the satire. So that was good. Essentially, it's the plot itself is kind of a satire of super teams, and I suppose other entertainment groups having, you know, phenomenal success and then breaking up and then coming back together at the dramatically appropriate moment. And they've got two issues to put everything together and defeat the bad guys, but this issue really wanted me, or really made me want to go back and read the whole thing from the beginning. So thumbs up to it for that. Even with two pencilers and three inkers, I thought the art was fairly consistent throughout. I could tell Chris Cross's work over Panseca's, but I mean, and I like Chris Cross's stuff pretty well. It has a lot of energy, and fortunately he gets to do a lot, I think, of the fight scenes. But it's all good. Most Excellent Superbat gets a lot to do in this issue, which obviously makes sense since he's the uber fanboy of the group, as his costume and his code name indicate. There's also an appearance by Big Science Action, which is the sort of JSA to, or JLA to, it's the old folks as opposed to super young teams, you know, new hotness. And I know how, you know, square that phrase makes me sound. But anyway, overall a good issue. I enjoyed it. I'll go back and read the rest of it to see if it improves my estimation of the rest of the miniseries. Next is The Brave and the Bold, number 26, teaming up Zombie, spelled with an X, from the Milestone publishing line, and The Spectre. Zombie is a character who apparently cannot die because his body is kept alive by nanites. And obviously the Spectre is God's spirit of vengeance, bonded with a human host who used to be a Gotham City homicide detective. And this issue, you know, therefore is just a barrel of laughs because they go up against an angry ghost who was a psychotic killer in life, and in death he has turned into a psychotic hunter of other ghosts. So he essentially prevents them from reaching their final resting place. There's some talk about how this puts him beyond the Spectre's jurisdiction because the Spectre only deals with the living. But then Zombie can't get any traction with the guy either because he's a ghost and Zombie's, you know, a dude with nanotechnology keeping him alive. And the problem that I had, overall, it's a good issue. I keep forgetting to mention it was written by John Rossum and drawn by Scott Hampton. Hampton, I am used to seeing with a more painterly style, and this has elements of that, but it's a lot more definite in its line work, I suppose you'd say. It still looks mostly kind of washed out and ethereal, which of course is appropriate for the subject matter. I'm looking at one panel of a phone which is colored red and white. It looks like the Powerpuff Girls hotline. And I have to say, I knew nothing about Zombie before I read this issue. So I didn't recognize it when he was brought into the story, even though he is on the cover of the book. I chalk that up in part, again, to my running pet peeve with modern comics, which is the first-person narrative caption taking the place of the omniscient narrator. So, other than that, I mean, Zombie and his Alfred play pretty heavily in the plot, and it would have been nice to have a little bit more background on them that, say, an omniscient narrator could have provided. But I think Rossum did pretty well with the tools he chose to use. It ends on a sort of indefinite, you know, I look forward to further adventures with you, my new comrade, kind of note that, say, a TV crossover would, kind of like when the people from The Practice would show up on Ally McBeal, you know, and it'd be like, oh, we kind of do the same things, and we, it makes sense for us to run around in the same circles, but we don't have to see each other all the time, but we probably will. I mean, it was a decent one-off issue. Again, these milestone DC crossovers have been a good example, I think, of what the Brave and the Bold can do, and I'm glad to support the book. But this was not, I think, probably the Static and Black Lightning or the Blue Beetle Hardware issues were a little bit more, made a little bit more use of their characters than this one. Next is Blackest Night Superman number 1, written by James Robinson, penciled by Eddie Barrows, inked by Rui Jose and Julio Ferreira. Pronunciation again. And I enjoyed this Blackest Night crossover miniseries, or this first issue of said miniseries, a lot more than I did the Blackest Night Batman from, I think, last week. It's essentially Superman, Superboy, and Krypto teaming up to save Smallville from the Earth 2 Superman, who's been Black Lantern-fied and who, with, special guest Black Lantern, I suppose, is out to thoroughly ruin Superman's life by desecrating pretty much all of Smallville. And so it's a big fight issue, essentially, which honestly I think is sort of what we expect out of these Blackest Night miniseries, more than, say, the existential dilemma of Deadman that we got in the Blackest Night Batman miniseries. I mean, because there's only so much Zombie, I hesitate to use that word because I know Geoff Johns does not like it. There's only so much heart-ripping out, emotion-sensing, taunting from beyond the grave that one can take between a particular set of characters in the Blackest Night book itself. And so these little spin-off miniseries give you a nice opportunity to see that focused laser-like on a particular subset of characters, such as Superman, Superboy, Krypto, and Ma Kent. And the promised desecration of Jonathan Kent's grave doesn't really pay off this issue, but you know, you still got two more issues to go. Eddie Barrows, he's a pretty decent artist, he and his inkers. The best thing probably about the art in this issue is the sort of the Emoto vision. That's not a reference to any purple prose, no pun intended, but it's by Rod Rice doing the colors. And when they see, like, when a Black Lantern sees a particular emotion in a character, that character gets false colored with like yellow or red or green or something. Superman has a whole panoply of emotions at one point, so that's kind of cool. But other than that, it's just the same old, you know, ooh, I'm dead and I'm gonna get you and I'm taunting you because I'm not just a zombie kind of thing. But I mean, that has its place. And I think Robinson does a good job sort of building dread and really toying with these taboo ideas without sort of fetishizing them. Or, you know, at some point, it's just comics. It's just superhero comics. And Robinson's kind of come under the gun lately with the cry for justice and sort of going all emo and everything. And I think he still has enough good taste to pull everybody back from the brink and not go too far, even if Black Lantern Pa Kent shows up, you know, in issue two. So I like Blackest Night Superman number one. Looking forward to the next two issues. Over in the regular Superman books, Supergirl 44 and Superman Annual number 14 both came out last week. Supergirl number 44 is written, drawn by the regular team of Sterling Gates, Jamal Eagle, and John Sibal. It is essentially interchangeable, I think, with the rest of the Codename Patriot issues, except it features, my gosh, they have really skankified Cat Grant in Supergirl. I mean, she's wearing an outfit that would make Kim Cattrall's Sex and the City character, upon whom I suspect she is modeled rather closely, blush pretty hard. But this is another big fight issue. I suppose this is the big fight issue of, or one of the big fight issues of Codename Patriot, because it features not only Supergirl, but Superman and Mon-El as they fight rogue Kryptonians all over the world, including in Las Vegas, where the art team gets to do some nice aerial shots of the Vegas Strip. Excuse me. But there's not much, really. I know this is part of a crossover, and I know that Supergirl, the comic, has been pretty heavily invested in the whole new Krypton storyline, almost from the moment that this current creative team took over. It seems like they've been on the book for about a year now, or they're coming up on a year. I haven't done the math, but they've been on the book for a while. It's been almost all new Krypton. But you only get little flashes of, oh, hey, this is Supergirl's regular book. And that's kind of annoying. Eagle and Sibal are a nice team. Oh, Atlas, I should say, also shows up in this issue and has a little throwdown with Raldar. They do action well. They draw Superman well. I should say the other little flash of, by the way, this is Supergirl's own book. She gets a nasty look from Lois Lane, which of course refers to Supergirl's role in Lois' sister's death a few issues back. I mean, if you're reading Codename Patriot, it's a good addition to that storyline. As part of the regular Supergirl book, I'm sure Codename Patriot will pay off somehow, but it just reads sort of like It doesn't, it's not a good standalone issue, is what I'm saying. There are better issues of Supergirl to come in on. And the same is true, I think, to an even greater degree for the Superman Annual, which was also written by James Robinson and drawn by Javier Pena. It tells the, I suspect, untold story of the planet Daxam, which is Mon-El's home planet. It has a lot more to do with Daxam than it does Mon-El. Daxam, in a nutshell, is to Krypton as Romulus is to Vulcan, which, you know, probably doesn't surprise anyone, but it sort of compares and contrasts the extent to which both planets are xenophobic and the degree to which that influenced their space travel, because there is a bit of a flap a couple of years ago, I think, when Kurt Busiek in the regular Superman books did the storyline called The Third Kryptonian, which established that Krypton, back in the way olden days, had a pretty substantial star fleet. And of course, fans were like, well, if Krypton had spaceflight, then why aren't there more Kryptonians spread throughout the universe, and yada, yada, yada. And why didn't they all just leave Krypton, or why didn't more of them leave Krypton when Jor-El started shooting his mouth off? And this book kind of answers that in a very roundabout way. And you really kind of have to, I think you almost have to read between the lines and kind of be aware of that problem and be aware of the arguments for and against it in order to appreciate that. So that's a long way of saying there's a lot of inside baseball sort of information in this annual. It does have some decent art from Mr. Pena. He draws like this artist who used to be on one of the Star Trek books that DC put out. Her name was Rachel Skelton. It's, again, it almost looks like, at times, I know I made this comparison with an Agents of Atlas, with Claude St. Aubin, I think, in Agents of Atlas a couple of weeks ago. But Pena's figures almost look like Howard Chaykin characters in spots. The has a sort of fuzzy, thin line that Chaykin has used in recent years. But then other places, it doesn't. It's not like it's a total swipe of one artist. Overall, I enjoyed the art. Pena does a good job with the various things he's asked to draw, be they modern day Earth or ancient Daxam. The sort of the other alien worlds of the DC universe, including Kalinor, there's some Thanagarians, and the some other historical scenes as well. There's a big reveal toward the end of the issue, which again did not surprise me a whole heck of a lot, given the context of the issue. But, I mean, I don't know. I've been missing the latest Superman secret files, and I have a feeling that with all this new Krypton stuff, if you really want to understand it, you've got to sort of put all these disparate puzzle pieces together. And that can be rewarding if you have the time and inclination to do it. But, me not so much. There's not a whole lot of young Superman or young Clark in this issue. There is a lot of Mon-El sort of sitting around like Angel, sort of brooding about his place in history. And the meditations on what makes a Kryptonian or proto-Kryptonian society so stuck on itself are interesting in and of themselves, but I wanted to like this annual a lot, and I just couldn't. It fell short. I don't dislike it, but there are just so many little things so many little moments that go into it, and they never really coalesced into anything concrete. So maybe I'll read it again, and I'll have a different opinion, but not the best first impression. Next up is Justice League of America number 36, written by Len Wein. I'm going with Len Wein. Penciled by Tom Derenick, and inked by a whole platoon: Marlo Alcleza, Dan Green, and Walden Wong. And you have heard my criticisms of Tom Derenick's work previously. If you've been listening to the podcast, he tends to make every character rather beefy and almost sometimes cartoonishly distorted. And for somebody to be cartoonishly distorted in a superhero book, that's saying a lot. This is not one of Derenick's better issues. Last issue was a lot better. This is more of the Justice League beating up on the Royal Flush Gang, unaware that the real problem is with Amos Fortune and his new partner in crime, Roulette. A lot of the issue is devoted to the secret origin of Amos Fortune, which is not as fascinating as you might think. Essentially, it is the story of how he uses luck. He learns to manipulate luck, and from there he forms the Royal Flush Gang, he franchises out the Royal Flush Gang, and winds up running into the Justice League over and over again, because, as I pointed out last issue, whenever the JLA needs rebooting or just a tune-up, who do they call but the Royal Flush Gang? I suppose the big development in this issue is that Wonder Woman shows up to lend the team her credibility, and it looks like she'll be around next issue as well. So if you are following JLA, hoping that one or more of the big three will rejoin the team, you may have a little squee of excitement with this issue. And it's not, I mean, I think everybody does what they can with what they have, but it made me look forward to James Robinson and Mark Bagley. Next to last this week is Streets of Gotham number 3, which gets into the Tommy Elliott posing as Bruce Wayne philanthropist subplot, I think to the exclusion of the other characters who were introduced in Streets of Gotham number 1, you know, the little teenage runaway and her hulking protector. The lead story, the Tommy Elliott story, was written by Paul Dini, drawn by Dustin Nguyen, and inked by Derek Friedolfs. And essentially it is, as Dick and Damian tell us pretty early on, Tommy is bankrupting Bruce Wayne essentially by giving all of his fortune to charity and using that for the betterment of Gotham City. And that is stretched out into the lead story, which is padded out, well, I shouldn't say padded out, which is broken up with more subplots featuring the Penguin and Black Mask and Mr. Zazz, who, no surprise, is still fantasizing about killing people. So, I don't know. I should have a lot of faith in Paul Dini. But the way that this issue plays out, it's just like it takes about 20 pages to tell, let's say, 5 pages worth of story. There's not a whole lot of drama. The Tommy is Bruce subplot was introduced, it seems like, a year ago. I know it was about 6 months ago. Again, when Dini and Nguyen were on Detective Comics. And it was pretty well resolved, I thought, back then. And this feels just like a way to sort of resuscitate it by way of protecting Bruce's secret identity. The co-feature, the Manhunter co-feature, was written by Mark Andreyko, penciled by Georges Gentil, and inked by Carl Story and Jack Purcell. It is Kate Spencer's, Kate, I should say, as opposed to Manhunter, because she's not in costume, fight with Jane Doe, the skinless female serial killer, who I feel compelled to point out is actually naked throughout the story, but because she is skinless, I suppose it doesn't count. Essentially, Jane chases Kate through the woods. Kate keeps trying to find her main Manhunter weapon, which is her power staff, and or trying to find Huntress, her colleague in Birds of Prey, and all builds up to what I initially read as kind of a Deus Ex Machina ending, but I can, on closer inspection, I suppose the ultimate resolution was laid out pretty fairly. I give Gentil and his inkers credit for how they draw Huntress's costume, which is her midriff bearing version of the Jim Lee midriff bearing version of her outfit. They kind of draw it to make it look like a school uniform, which I suppose some people, I don't mean it in a sort of Britney Spears, you know, oh that's so naughty kind of way, but it looks a lot better than it has a right to. And otherwise their art's really quite good, quite nice to look at. It's helped a great deal by Nick Filardi, the colorist, who uses a nice watercolor-ish palette. He washes everything out. His woodland scenes look really nice, especially his use of light. And nice little action sequence packed into 8 pages or so. And we finish up with Wednesday Comics number 7, which is pretty heavy on the guest stars, even in the individual features. Dr. Fate shows up in the Adam Strange feature. Aquaman shows up in Supergirl and points Supergirl to Dr. Midnight. It's a little unsettling, especially in the Adam Strange feature, because you're like, Dr. Fate? You know, who is expecting Dr. Fate in an Adam Strange book? And Paul Pope explains that they're both related to archaeologists or archaeology, but that's kind of a stretch. The Wonder Woman feature continues to improve, I think, mainly since it's found sort of Etta Candy to sort of point things out for the reader and put a good face on the sort of esoteric adventures that Wonder Woman is having. The rest of it, it's about the same as it has been. Teen Titans is probably the biggest disappointment. Batman, I think. I know some people do not like the Batman feature because it's a collection of noir cliches sort of run through the Batman filter. But I appreciate it because I think it is kind of a parody of noir cliches run through the Batman filter. The standouts, as usual, are Commandy and the Flash. The Superman feature is improving since he's found something to punch. I usually don't like seeing angry eyes, heat vision emphasized on Superman, but, you know, 5 issues or so of him moping around Smallville and Metropolis, it's a nice change of pace. And with that, my voice is starting to give out, so we'll call it quits for this week. Thanks for listening. Thanks for putting up with my ailment, and I will talk to you hopefully in a little stronger position in a couple of days, or, you know, for too long. Talk to you later.